This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Today, in our Greek Cafe Neo, I've got with me Christos Tsiolkas, one of Australia's most popular writers. Chris, welcome to the show.
It's a great pleasure.
You're going to be the beautiful in the gold and the beautiful today.
That is extremely kind of you. I'm not sure if I'm up to that challenge, but thank you.
So I say to friends when I talk about you that you are Greek-Australian gay royalty.
I'm not quite sure how many contenders are there for that throne. You know,
being a royal, that means that you don't have anyone else that goes for it.
It's really interesting that that mixture of identities there, all of them very important to me. All of them I want to challenge and think about and are constantly in a state of flux. It's interesting that.
Is there a competition between the three?
For a long time, certainly. For a long time. And I think that for a long time the competition was also dominated by one that wasn't in their class. What does a working class identity mean? With the success of The Slap, the previous novel, and it doing so well financially, it kind of disoriented me in the sense that suddenly I knew firmly something that I had been dealing with for over 20 years, that, you know, someone who proudly came from an immigrant working class background was no longer that. And I had been shifting not being that for a long time. But the economic surety that came with The Slap made me realise that, I can no longer claim that identity as mine. I can claim its history and be passionate about exploring that history and what it still means in Australia. And I think that's partly why class is such a dominant theme in the new novel. But I'm using the example of class to say how every point, you know, Greek, Australian, gay, is complex. And they all do rub up against each other. And for a long time, I thought, particularly as an adolescent, that there was no way of reconciling the gay and the Greek. I thought that was an impossibility, that I had to make a choice for one or the other. I certainly don't think that now.
I'll just switch to Greek now. Δίνεις το παράδειγμα how you can have both to a lot of us.
Oh, look, that's very generous. I mean, I think part of it is, part of it is actually... And I'm not being falsely humble here. Part of it, Kyriakos, is a historic moment. You know, that I was the great shift in Australian identity, particularly urban Australian identity, was the dismantling of the White Australia policy, which changed the nature of the colonial. It's a colonial nation.
Did it change the mindset?
No. But that's what I was going to say. That, you know, so my father migrated in 1955, my mother in 1964. So in a way, I was part of that first wave, that first generation that was going to actually become part of the Australian voice. You know, so previous to that, there had been very little written from the migrant voice. Or the second generation migrant voice. And so, again, without trying to be falsely humble, I'm just saying that that was that I was there at the right moment for that articulation to happen.
But that articulation was so intense. You know, Haydon said so many truths about growing up Greek, Australian, and gay. And I remember watching this. Because I didn't read it, I watched it in the cinema, I remember, at Como, and I was shocked. I was fresh in Australia, probably 4 years. I had no contact with the community, with that particular lifestyle. I had contact with the community, not with the lifestyle. I lived in Adelaide, which was quite different. So I remember the only thing that touched me was the sun. And the father scene when Ari is dancing in front of his father. Only later on, I realized that, wow, this is not agrio. This is real. This is really how people grow up in Australia.
Yes. Look, it's interesting that you talk about that scene. And, you know, I don't want to take credit for something that Anna Kokkinos directed, and I think quite beautifully. But I think that the wildness in Loaded, the book, is there, and the rage. And I think that is part of living that. As I said, it felt like I had to make a choice between my sexuality and my ethnicity, and somehow that they were not to be reconciled. What I am really thankful for is that I raged against that choice, and that's partly where Loaded came from, and where a lot of my writings come from, is refusing to make that choice. And the reason why it's interesting you talk about the father-son relationship is I think that it's by remaining connected to a notion of family that I've found a way of avoiding having to make it a choice. I think it's no accident that if there is a theme that connects all my books, it's actually the theme of family.
Mm-hmm.
And not to, you know, family is such a complicated area. Family is the site of some great hurt. But for me, it's also the site of some great forgiveness and some great love and tenderness. And when you talk about that scene, you're talking about tenderness.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been my battle, is to try and think about what does family mean? What does family mean for this queer wog guy who doesn't want to abandon it, but wants to be able to live within it? That's a search. I'm 48 now, and I don't think that will ever be fully settled.
Mm-hmm.
But the rage was really important in terms of getting me to think about those things. Certainly important, but increasingly the tenderness is of equal value, I think.
Do we see you in the books? The change in writing and the change in the characters, is there? Do you put Christos in your books? Is Danny, for example, a bit of Christo, or is Ari a bit of Christo?
I think that the first novels, that's a good question and also quite a complicated question. Yes, I think there is a truth that I adhere to a form of nakedness in writing that means that there's always an element of my experience, and partly, you know, that's in part his influences. So, you know, who were the writers that absolutely, you know, rocked my world, you know, when, you know, from youth, and you know, I keep mentioning people like Norman Mailer, Henry Miller, Carson MacArthur's, Jean Genet, Pasolini. I'm not trying to be an egghead, but these were they're actually all writers who have a very distinctive voice.
Mm-hmm.
And their autobiography is part of the world they create. Having said that, however, the more confident you get that this is your craft, the more interested you become in the notion of story, and the more aware you become that there is a limitation to the autobiographical experience. You know, so I think my challenge is to remain true to a voice, because I think that you know, you need to have a voice as a writer. You need to be able, you need to hear the voice as much as read the voice, I think, sometimes, but also not to be solipsistic, not to remain only in my head. So to answer your question, and I apologize for this being a long-winded answer, certainly there are elements of Danny Kelly's story that are that I relate to completely, but certainly also including the fact that I'm not obviously not a champion athlete. I'm not Danny Kelly. In fact, I would say to you, Kiriakos, if there's anyone in Barracuda that is me, it's actually his friend Demet.
Ah, Demet.
Yeah. For people who don't know the book, Demet is Danny's best friend from primary school. She's a Turkish-Australian mm-hmm. girl.
And she uses a really interesting way to describe the college.
Yeah, but I'm not sure if we're allowed to say.
It's in college.
It's somewhere in the leafy eastern suburbs.
So we've just talked about Barracuda, which is your latest book.
It's just literally come out. It came out at the end of October. It's always nerve-wracking when a book is out, because of, you know, I always thought it would get easier, but it doesn't. You're in a way even more aware of the that, you know, people will be reading it, people will be judging it, and it's a nerve-wracking. It is a difficult experience. But having said that, you know, it took me a long while to get to Barracuda because the last novel, The Slap, had been so successful that I was disoriented, obviously in a good way. I don't want to be a whinge. I was very glad and I feel very fortunate about the success. But it just meant I had to make sure that I could fight through the white noise of expectation and actually write a book that I wanted to write.
It's interesting to see somebody so accomplished to expose this, you know, uncertainty, insecurity about, I don't know if my book is going to do well. Do you think that will ever go?
Of course not, and I don't think that there is any artist of any kind who doesn't feel that anxiety. It's the best way for me to express it is every time you put out a book, and I'm sure it's the same, you ask a filmmaker puts out a film, or it's like you've just stripped off your clothes and you're walking down the middle of the street naked and going, what do you think? I think that one of the reasons I chose to write about a sports person in the new book is that I came to the subject through this experience and feeling almost envious of how quantifiable the sporting achievement was. Mm-hmm. You know, who's the first swimmer across the line, the first athlete across the finishing line, they know they are the best in their competition, in their city, in their country, in the world, if we're getting to the Olympics. No artist has that surety. No artist will know if their work will truly have a life outside their own. You know, you will die not knowing that, you know, how. Having said that, I no longer, having worked on this book and research and lived with it for close to 3 years, I no longer have that envy of the sports person, because what I realised in writing the book was that whatever the work is, I'm confident enough to know that I will write till the end of my time. Mm-hmm. You know, touch wood, unless there's some great, you know, tragic accident, that I can be a frail old man and I can still be writing. Whereas that is something that the athlete can't have. And it's so, you know, going back to that notion of tenderness, I really felt for some of the young kids I interviewed in writing this book, who I, as a writer, I could see their obsession, I could understand their dedication, how broken they were when their bodies failed them.
The book talks about, I think it's more about failure rather than winning.
Of course. It's a much more interesting subject.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think gays and lesbians feeling the failure more intensely than somebody that just lives a normal straight life? Because there is another layer as a gay person. At least for me, it was, I had this notion of failure and shame.
Oh, look, so much of, you know, Loaded comes out of that struggle of failing. I can only speak about it as a gay man failing in my sexuality, in my masculinity. You know, that was a really long and difficult part of my struggle to create a truly adult self in the world. You know, and I think that the first three novels are very much an examination of what it means to be, what does masculinity mean. You know, how do we reconcile masculinity with our sexuality? And there's no simple answer to that. I still think about my erotic desires, and I know that I am forever caught in that
conditioning
that those, you know, sometimes quite poisonous ideas of what it is to be a man, what it is to be a woman. But, you know, what I do have is a consciousness of that, and an attempt to want to challenge that, and I'm really, really fortunate for it. Having said that, Kiriakos, I will say what was different with Barracuda. It was a real, you know, Danny came to me as a voice before anything. You know, I heard this young boy's voice as an adolescent, and he was, you know, he just had this will, this ferocious will. But also what came to me almost immediately was that I knew that he, as an adult, and the book, to explain to listeners, it runs for the most part third person chronologically forward. So we see him as a 14-year-old and ends in a man in his 30s, but every alternate chapter is in the first person and it goes chronologically backwards. So we see Danny at the beginning as a 34-year-old man and we see him at the end as an 8-year-old child. And they're much shorter chapters. But the story of the boy at high school, because he's so focused on his body, is not a gay story. But the man we see right at the beginning is a man in a relationship with another man. He's a gay man.
In another country.
In another country. But what I wanted to do, one of the challenges I set myself with Barracuda was that I didn't want to write the coming out story. You know, I think in a way that story has been told in so many different ways. I don't think the potency of that story is lost, but I'm writing from within the West, writing from in a society like Australia. It's very, very hard to do that story differently now. And I just wanted to trust readers that actually they could read this story, they could understand Danny Kelly without having to hear the coming out story, without having to hear the challenge it posed for his family. And so I hope that readers will respond to that, that readers will accept that this is a possibility, because what I think is exciting about that possibility, to go back to that question about our failed sexuality, is that maybe it points to something changing in the culture. Danny Kelly doesn't feel failure because of his sexuality. He feels failure because of he's not as morally strong a man as he wants to be. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is now a much more exciting story. Mm-hmm. And now I think we can accept that anyone, woman or man listening to this, straight or gay or in between listening to this, knows that's the more important story.
So being a good person, being a good man or a good woman, let's bring it back to Greek Australians or Greeks. For a Greek Australian that has that moment of truth, that says, I'm also gay, what happens? Are you a good man or are you a good woman? Is that a challenging moment? Can you be both a good gay man?
Look, I think the what I'm trying to say is that the moment, and this is where I think it's important to step away from always the autobiography, and to realise that what we mean by both those terms, what we mean by Greek and what we mean by Australian, has changed. And good. They're always changing. There is a very distinct reason why Danny Kelly in this novel, his mother is a second generation Greek. His father is Scots-Irish background, because I think that reflects something about the changing nature of Australian society, and that just as much as growing up in Australia has challenged and my notion of what it was to be a Greek man and what it means to be a good Greek man, I think growing up in an Australia that has been so transformed by the waves of immigration means that the notion of what it means to be an Australian good woman, an Australian good man, has been changed as well. Mm-hmm. And part of that change is that we have these hybrid identities, and we have these hybrid identities that keep extending. You know, so like, is Danny Greek, or is he Irish, or is he Scots, or is he Australian, or is he all those things? And what does that mean for ethnic identity?
Okay. Well, let's talk about your ethnic identity. What is Greek in your life today?
The Greekness is family, I'm very conscious of that. I lost my father just over a year ago, and the recognition of being the son of someone who was such an honourable person and such a loving person, and that part of the love he had for his children and part of the code of honour that he had stemmed from his Greek heritage. I'd make it even more specific than that. I would say it stemmed from being the child of a rural Greek world in which notions of loyalty were very, very strongly marked in his childhood and in his youth, and that he wanted to give his children those lessons. But that honouring that relationship, and I include my mother in that too, that notion of family feels very Greek. It still feels very Greek. The fact that I still can, sometimes when I'm at my most vulnerable, or when I'm my most joyous, or when I'm at my most distressed, I fall into Greek. into the Greek language, because I think maybe it was the first language I spoke, so it has an emotional resonance for me that is not is different in English. And I was really I've a few times it's happened in reviews and commentary where I've people have said of my work, he doesn't write like an Englishman, he writes like something else. Now, I remember friends saying, well, that means you write like a Greek man, you know, which is possible. I think that, I actually think that's something valuable in literature and in our identity, that we who are bilingual and trilingual and speak, can actually, it's a great gift you have as a writer to be able to think through different grammars.
Yes,
and what different and syntax, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it gives you a freedom. And I don't think it's an accident that some of the greatest writers in the English language have been people who didn't grow up with English. You look at Nabokov, the Russian writer, who, because of the revolution, his family moved to Western Europe, and he became America, and he became one of the great writers of English. Mm-hmm. Joseph Conrad, the same, mm-hmm. grew up Polish. English was his third language, and he's one of the great stylists of the English language. Don't get me wrong, I'm not comparing myself to them, but I'm just saying that there's a possibility in being in language that I think we should celebrate. And I think that that's a possibility that's still emerging, and I hope Australian writing takes on, that we don't have to write. I said this the other day to a friend, I get pissed off at how many Australian writers want to write the great English novel. The English will always beat us at this game, right?
Yeah.
I think that we use the history that we have here as Australians, which is multicultural and Indigenous, as much as it is colonial, and we transform the language. James Joyce didn't write the great novel Ulysses or Portrait of the Artist as a young man by imitating the English. He used his Irish roots to completely challenge and transform English. Same as the Americans from Twain, from Melville. They didn't want to write the English novel. They wanted to write the great American novel. I think I know this is going far from your question, but the connection to it is, I think that as I become more aware of the mutation in my identity, and I look at my nieces and nephews around me, and they are Greek and Australian, and they're Chinese and Greek and Australian, and they are, Dutch and Burmese and all those different permutations, I just get really, really excited of what the language will look like.
So did you discuss the book with your Greek translator?
That's happening at the moment. So that's going to be, that's always, translation is really fascinating. Translation is all about nuance, and translation in a way is a rewriting of the novel. And I don't envy, them the task ahead, because it's also making sure that those specificities of the Australian English are not lost and are able to be communicated to the Greek reader.
Will you have a say in the Greek book?
I will. Translating experience has been when the translator just sends me a whole series of questions about the language that I've used. That's when you know that they're really responding to the book. And so that will happen. That's happened with the Greek translator. At the end, my Greek isn't good enough. I wish it were, to be able to make the call of how good the Greek is.
The Greek is. So apart from family, what else is Greek in your life? Do you listen to Greek music? Do you watch Greek TV, listen to Greek radio, or Greek sites, or...
I listen to Greek music, certainly.
And what type of Greek music?
I'm such a traditionalist. You would be. I rarely listen to contemporary stuff unless, some of my cousins may send me something. Saying of that, I was actually in the early, was it the early 2000s? I really liked some of that electronica that was coming out of Greece. I really like Stereo Nova and those group of people, and I think there's still some really interesting electronica coming up from Greece. I tend to listen, you know, my favourite, the great Rimbetica. I can't help it. I love Delatus, so I'll always listen to him. You know, in a way, I feel I'm quite conservative with my Greek music. I was very, very excited the last 5 years by Dogtooth. Kinodos, yeah, and Alps, and I just think that there's something very, and Strela, I think there is something fascinating happening in Greek cinema for the first time in a long time. I think I love Angelopoulos, and I love that cinema of the late 60s. But I was just saying, I think there's the Greek cinema has been dominated by Angelopoulos for such a long time that it's really interesting to see something as wickedly funny and intellectually stimulating and truly cinematic as Dogtooth and Alps. I thought they were great film.
And will we get the chance to see Barracuda in the movies?
It's such a hard question. I think that you could never ever assume that a work will be translated into another medium. I've been very, very fortunate. You know, The Slap was done as a miniseries that Loaded became head-on, Dead Europe became the film. But what is important at this moment is to just remember that I wrote it as a novel. I didn't write it as a script. I didn't write it as a play. I wrote it as a novel for a particular reason, and that's because I wanted to do something with the language and the structure as a writer. I would love it to be made into a film, and I think more a film, this one, than it lends itself to a film. But you can only make that call when you sit down with a director or a writer in film who says, this is the reason I want to make this story into a film. This is... and to see them excited about transforming it into another medium. There's always a leap of faith that you must make in that relationship.
So you're saying to us that that hasn't happened yet?
Oh, yes, sorry. Yeah, I guess that's what I'm saying. I've had, because it's only been a week now since it's been released, there have been people who have asked about the rights, but I've just gone back to them and said, I want you to read it. I want you to sit with it. And maybe after Christmas, if people are, because as I said, I don't actually want them to respond to the fact that Christos Tsolkas has got a new book out. I want them to respond to Barracuda.
Christos, thank you for being the beautiful in the gold, the beautiful.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Evkaristo.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.